election, the Honorable Justice Stiglitz presiding.
All right, everybody can have a seat. I call on case number 89741, Greenleaf Farms versus Belmont. Counsel, is everybody ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
We are, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Esposito?
Good afternoon, Justices. Excuse my familiarity with the process, but I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, if that's...
You have 15 minutes, you'd like to reserve 10 for rebuttal?
Oh, five, excuse me.
It'd be up to you.
It has been a long day, just humor me for a second, my gosh. All right, so, realistically, Your Honors, my name is Michael Esposito, I represent Greenleaf Farms Holdings. Heck of a first impression, thank you for bearing with me. What I'd like to start with here is kind of a summary of the case, because while there are a lot of issues that were raised in the moving papers, I think having a firm understanding of the history of this litigation is probably the most important factor in the arguments you're going to hear today. Now, in 2021, there was what we call the first action. The first action was a lawsuit that was brought relating to landlord-tenant disputes between the parties. On one side, you had the landlord, Belmont. On the tenant side, you had my client, Greenleaf Farms Holdings. Now, over the course of that lawsuit, there was an eviction. Greenleaf Farms Holdings challenged the propriety of the eviction, challenged the propriety of whether or not to exercise a purchase option, and a variety of other things that arose directly out of that landlord-tenant relationship. All of those issues were resolved in the first action. Now, this is important because this is something that Greenleaf Farms made abundantly clear in its moving papers to the district court below, because the second action, the action we are on appeal here for today, is primarily about the secured debtor, secured creditor relationship under NRS 104.9, or UCC Article 9.
And Mr. Esposito, I got to cut you off there because, and I don't, it's going to be flip, and I apologize in advance, but have you read the First Amendment complaint?
Yes, sir.
Because I don't see that as being about what you just said the case is about.
And Justice Kadish, I appreciate that because that, unfortunately, and I'm not the attorney that drafted the complaint, as I'm sure you're aware, but that is not an excuse.
I saw that.
Yes. We came in rather late in the process. And so one of the aspects of this case that I think does generate some of this confusion is the fact that this second action, the one that Justice Kadish is referring to, was filed before the resolution of the first action. Mm-hmm. So one glaring item that's in the First Amendment complaint that I think we all acknowledge throughout the argument is the fact that there is this comment that says, well, depending on what the Nevada Supreme Court says, this may or may not be applicable. Well, that pertained to the issues that Justice Kadish has rightfully pointed out were somewhat duplicative of the first action. The reason we're standing here today is because those issues were resolved, and when we became before the court, we focused on the remaining issues that were not resolved by the first action. So, Justice Kadish, when you read the First Amendment complaint, what I'm asking you to do is to segregate out the issues that were resolved by the order of affirmance of this court, which is not being challenged, from the issues that arise out of the direction of this court and of the district court. When the district court said the landlord is able to take the collateral, which is literally everything that Greenleaf had in that building, subject to the security agreements. We know there's multiple security agreements. We know that the security agreements in this state are subject to NRS 104.9. We know that the rights of a secured debtor under Article 9 are largely not waivable until after a judgment is entered and a new agreement is signed. That's a statutory prohibition. So Greenleaf was exercising its rights as a secured debtor on top of the issues that were essentially resolved by that order of affirmance that came down for the first action.
One of the bases for the court kind of summarily resolving a big bulk of the 10 claims was issue preclusion, which was not addressed in the opening brief and only kind of summarily mentioned in the reply. So why is that argument not waived, and why should we not affirm the court's decision on issue preclusion?
Because the issue preclusion decision, Your Honor, according to the actual language of the order, is limited to those issues that came out of the first action. We're not challenging those.
Well, she granted summary judgment on multiple claims in the operative pleading, the first amended complaint, based on issue preclusion and standing.
Correct.
And that's the way her order reads, is that it grants as to the first claim on both of those grounds and then incorporates that throughout the order. So isn't that one of the alternative grounds on which she granted summary judgment on several claims?
So when Judge Kishner entered the order, and I can pull the exact language if it helps the reference out, Your Honor, but basically when it came to issue preclusion, the court specifically referenced the propriety of the eviction and the other landlord-tenant issues that were raised. Let me get to that while we're talking. That's the reason that the court, who was more than willing to say that other issues are moot once they've been decided on a different legal basis. We saw that with MSJ Order 3, MSJ Order 5, et cetera. So Judge Kishner is more than willing to say, I've resolved this claim. We don't need to give you a separate legal basis for granting summary judgment. This particular instance, she felt the need to say, for the eviction, the landlord-tenant claims, issue preclusion applies. When it comes to the secure transaction claims, that, by definition, is something that Belmont, the landlord, argued in their moving papers and argues again before this court, was never actually litigated below. So that would
be
a separate legal basis.
Are you saying the court didn't grant summary judgment on those claims?
As to the summary judgment for the claims of breach based on aspects of the contract that arise out of the landlord-tenant relationship, yes.
That's not the order reads as granting summary judgment on the first cause of action. And then on the second cause of action, and then on the third cause of action, right? It didn't, right? Because otherwise, we don't even have a final judgment subject to appeal unless that's what happened.
So, Your Honor, getting to this, it says, and I'm on appellant's appendix, page 2225, the eviction was deemed to have conducted. The eviction was deemed to have been conducted after providing Greenleaf with a reasonable amount of time. Further, combining the first judgment's fact number 7, which says the lease permits reentry, and I understand that I'm kind of skipping over parts here, but the entire analysis of the issue preclusion issue, Your Honor, is with relation to the propriety of the eviction and the retaking of the premises.
But
and
based on that premise,
correct,
the actual district court in the actual case granted summary judgment on the claim. So if you were going to argue that issue preclusion shouldn't bar part of the claim or some of your claim that you're saying is claimed, wouldn't that have been an argument to raise in your opening brief?
Well, Your Honor, I'm standing before you now and I'm hearing, and I'm not trying to be evasive here. I'm really not, I promise.
It's okay, go ahead.
I am. But at the end of the day, our reading of the order, and this was obviously a judgment call on my part, and I'm happy to put that on the record, was that when you have, when you have multiple issues that are independent bases for asserting a breach of contract, and the court says, as to these issues, issue preclusion applies. We're granting summary judgment, and the court walks
summary
through.
Summary judgment on the claim because issue preclusion prevents them from proceeding.
So the order said, yes, barred by the doctrine of issue preclusion and Greenleaf's lack of standing. And so again, Your Honor, if I feel like I'm not properly satisfying your inquiry here, but at the end of the day, that was the general premise behind the way that the appeal was structured. If the court is inclined to say that that finding applies to everything, then I think we have a serious issue because we have both parties saying that that was not a legal issue that was raised below. We have the opposing brief here that says that none of these secure transaction issues were alleged. They're alleging they weren't pled in the complaint, right?
Right.
We're alleging they were, but that they were not resolved via the issue preclusion, but through the analysis of a lack of standing, which improperly relies upon 118C.
The only claims your client has or had are the ones that are actually asserted in the first amended complaint. Can
correct,
we agree
right
on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the operative pleading. That's your client's claims.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent summary judgment was granted on those claims, that doesn't leave anything else, does it?
Our position, Your Honor, remains that if you have multiple legal bases for asserting the claim, such as a breach of contract, that if the court grants summary judgment as to one of those alleged breaches, your claim maintains for the others.
So then there isn't a final judgment?
There is, because the other aspect of this resolved the remainder of the breach of contract claims. The standing issue is what resolves all of the Article 9 issues. It's the lack of standing in the order that says, and Your Honor, that's our position. I can read the room.
Appreciate that.
In terms of the intentional interference claim that was dismissed because the court found it was contractually waived, what do you say about that?
Well, that, Your Honor, we view as just a black and white reading of the contract. And again, that gets back to the whole difference between the landlord-tenant issues and the Article 9 issues. That waiver applies to issues that we were not contesting below. So when you read the contractual waiver, it talks about things like re-entry of the premises, re-letting the premises, damage to the premises. Anything relating to whether or not Belmont as a landlord had a right to the premises has not been challenged here. And that was that's why when I opened my argument, I said the fundamental issue here is trying to draw that line between the Article 9 secured debtor, secured creditor issues and the landlord-tenant issues.
So I just want to be clear. After our court affirmed the judgment in the first action.
Correct.
And your briefing says repeatedly that, you know, we then made it clear that we weren't disputing those issues and we're proceeding on this theory. But I want to be clear, though, after that affirmance, there was no attempt to amend the complaint in this case. Is that right?
There was no motion filed to amend the complaint, Your Honor. And there was no time, but well, I'm not going to blame time. We did not, in the limited amount of time that we had, use that time to either file a request to amend or to go to the other side and discuss dismissal of those issues. We treated them as done. And in fact, when we were talking to opposing counsel, when we were filing the briefing, that's why we were trying to explain to the court, these are not claims that are being pursued.
And why was it improper for the court to strike all of your damages, which would then render all of your other claims moot?
And Justice Lee, I appreciate that. The issue with the damages here is very simple. The information had been available to Belmont since 2021.
Now, but in the form of various documents. But why not just comply with the rule where you have to put in a disclosure statement your computation of damages categorically, not by claim. I agree with you that you don't have to do claim by claim damages, but categorically. And that wasn't done until 17 months after your initial disclosure, 2 weeks before the close of discovery. And there was really no explanation for the delay.
No, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I can't speak for prior counsel, and I'm not using them as a shield here. We took the case. Within 30 days, we had digested all the documentation. We saw the disclosures. We supplemented the disclosures categorically with computations of damages in accordance with our understanding of the rule.
Right. I mean, it's not their job to put together, well, they disclosed this document on that day, and 6 months later, they submitted an affidavit with an injunction motion. Like that, it's your, as the plaintiff's obligation, not you. Plaintiff's obligation to make a disclosure of a computation of damages.
100%, Your Honor. And candidly, the only reason that we're bringing this issue up is because the Supreme Court and other aspects of 16.1 has been willing to say if the information has been out there and available, it is considered disclosed. The Nevada Supreme Court has done this with witness testimony or with witness identification. The rule for damages computation, part of that particular component of 16.1 says you have to make the documents available to support the computation, which is the basis for us saying in 2021, we gave the inventory, we gave the declaration, we gave the contracts.
So then the court abused her discretion when she said she was striking your damages.
The striking of the damages is an extreme remedy for something where they had, and not only did they have the information, but they used it at deposition. There were a variety of other remedies under 37 that could have been done. And I understand that there is some argument that the exclusionary rule under 37 is automatic. But to the extent that it wipes a claim, or in this case, all of the claims out in their entirety, that is a case terminating sanction for a case where they had detailed information and they used that detailed information on these damages calculations during the 30B6 corporate designee deposition of my client. So yeah, why was that computation not done immediately? I have no answer for the court.
Do you want to reserve your last minute?
I would love that, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, nope, she's not done, sorry.
Wait one second, so, and I'm going to give you time for rebuttal, because I want to hear, I want to hear what you're going to say. What do we make of the fact that the court in the first action gave council the opportunity to address offset below, and instead you filed a second action?
Sure, and Your Honor, I think the order of affirmance actually addressed that by saying that the Greenleaf had the right and undertook the opportunity to, I think the language was take a separate path.
I think it was that the court didn't abuse its discretion by not considering offset when you went a different direction.
And candidly, I agree with the court on that point, Your Honor. I don't, again, I can't speak for prior counsel. Me, and we were talking about this beforehand, going through everything that's been said. I don't think the court abuses discretion by denying the request for an offset. I think the answer was correct in saying that a separate action being brought was the appropriate vehicle for doing that. And there's contractual basis for that too that we don't have time to get into, but there is a waiver issue. Your Honor, if it pleases the court, I'll just wrap up very quickly.
Well, counsel, I'm gonna have you hold that. I'm gonna give you 3 minutes rebuttal.
Sure.
Only if you sit down right now. And I'll give you, you're out of time, so I'll
give
you 3 minutes.
I got you, Your Honor.
You can
wrap
up at the very end. Mr. Gardner, we'll give your side 18 minutes.
Oh.
And, well, 15 plus 3.
Right.
This is the kind of math that we do here.
Okay.
And will Ms. Lucero be, are you splitting the argument?
Yes.
Okay.
May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Rex Gardner, and I represent Belmont, the landlord, and Ryan Carlson, the landlord's agent who helped to effectuate the eviction. I'm here with co-respondent counsel, Elsie Lucero. We intend to divide the time evenly among the issues that we identified in our notice of appearance. I understand you may ask me some questions about those issues. I'll do my best to answer them. But first of all, welcome Justice Lee, welcome Justice Kadish, and welcome back Justice Stiglitz to this case. A case that has been going on 4 years and has exhausted a lot of judicial and party resources, all stemming from the failure of Greenleaf to abide by its contractual obligations. The district court in the first action granted summary judgment. This court affirmed, and on the eve of the arguments in the first case, Greenleaf filed the second action. At the close of discovery in that second action, which brings us here today, the defendants filed 5 separate motions for summary judgment, because that is what the claims suggested as multiple avenues, multiple bridges to cross the river that is the lack of merit for all of the claims that Greenleaf had brought. And you can affirm on any one or all of them, including arguments.
Even the ones the court didn't address below?
Yes. Yes, your presidents say whatever the record will support, even if the district court got to the right decision by the wrong road, we can get there. One of the arguments that has been allocated to me between us is standing. It turns out that when Greenleaf sued us for destruction, according to them, destruction of their property, even though they had not identified in their pleadings the UCC, Article 9, commercial reasonableness, or auctions, the pleadings did not actually identify these issues. And although the pleadings rules are generous, they are not limitless. They still have to give us some idea of what they're suing us. Otherwise, Rule 8 and Rule 12 are dead letters, and all you really need to do is have I, plaintiff, sue you, defendant, for anything that sticks, and that's good enough. But the district court below properly found that's not good enough. And Greenleaf continued its habit in this case.
You know, let me ask you about that, Mr. Gardner, because the court's orders that ended up granting summary judgment on all the claims through a few different paths didn't directly address the secured creditor arguments. The the court did address bailment and said wasn't pleaded and it's too late, but didn't address the kind of secured party theory. Can you address that?
Not with the thoroughness that I think that these issues have been ventilated here now on appeal, but they were litigated below in the summary judgment motions. And the problem that we have is that Greenleaf, according to it, sued us for damage to their collateral. The district court judge granted summary judgment against that claim, to the extent it was pleaded, on at least two different bases. One is issue preclusion that Ms. Lucero will address. The other is standing. Because whether Greenleaf sued us for converting that property or they sued us for mishandling that property, in either case, that property has to belong to the plaintiff.
But isn't there a difference between ownership of the property and still having an interest as a secured debtor in the property? Because the UCC does grant the debtor some rights.
Yes.
In terms of how you handle that collateral once it's seized, correct?
Yes, absolutely correct. And the reason I bring that up, because ownership certainly matters with respect to conversion.
Sure.
I can't convert something that doesn't belong to the plaintiff. With respect to the secured collateral, what we have here is a couple of agreements, at least two agreements, paragraph 31 of the lease, and a separate standalone security agreement that govern this collateral. In both of those agreements, we have a handful of promises by Greenleaf, including that Greenleaf would provide us information about the ownership of that collateral upon request, including that Greenleaf will maintain title to that property, including that Greenleaf will not pledge that property to anyone else, including Greenleaf will keep that property insured. It turns out it complied with none of those things. And when we tried to abide by our obligation to treat this collateral properly and hold an auction, the record is very clear that when we sent them our notice that we're going to sell this property, it is our last and best chance to recover against you, tenant. So the idea that we would intentionally destroy it, it just does not make any sense, because we would love to be able to sell this and recoup some of our losses. What we got in response was, wait a minute, some of that stuff doesn't belong to us. Some of it has been pledged to other people, both of which are breaches of their agreement. So we said, we're going to stop the auction until you give us information on these creditors, because we can't hold this auction and essentially buy ourselves another lawsuit from another creditor. There is zero evidence that they ever provided us this information. So the theory is, by Greenleaf's case, we can't prevent you from doing what the contract requires and then sue you for not doing it. The district court, of course, saw through all of that. And even though, Justice Gaines, to your question, that's not found actually in any of her orders, it was part of the argument, it is part of the record, and it stands as an independent basis upon which you can affirm.
The district court found that those efforts were made to notify them of the upcoming auction, get information about any other interests in it, and that wasn't provided.
I mean, that's in the record. I can't recall if the summary judgment motion number one specifically refers to that. I know it did refer to the evidence that prior to the eviction, there were multiple notices to Greenleaf.
Right.
In March of 2021, we're going to evict you. Please remove personal property and please remove any cannabis, because we're not licensed.
Right. I was
to
just going to clarify that. So the pre-eviction notices were obviously recognizing, you know, Belmont was asserting a right to the collateral and,
correct,
you know, don't take that.
Right.
But what you can and should come and take are, you know, your truly personal items and the cannabis products.
Correct.
And I'm asking about that specifically because, to the extent the security agreements reference inventory, presumably cannabis was their inventory if they're in that business. So, but you were telling them to remove the cannabis products.
Yes.
your client, obviously.
Yes, obviously, we did not want to run afoul of the licensing requirements and take back a building and suddenly find ourselves in possession of controlled substances for which we have no license.
Got it.
So there were multiple pre-eviction notices saying, please remove all of the cannabis. And it turns out during discovery, we obtained from the Cannabis Control Board a letter from Greenleaf that said to the Cannabis Control Board, we removed everything prior to the eviction.
Right. There's some dispute, I think, in their reply brief about that they were removing some, I'm certainly no expert in this area, some plants, but not the mother plants or something of that nature.
Yes, I'm not an expert in that either. But the Cannabis Control Board, we subpoenaed them, we took their deposition, we got from them the, it's a seed to sale system that it's called Metric. All of those records are part of the record below, which show that prior to the eviction, everything that was in their registered system had been removed prior to the eviction.
Okay, that's what they told the Cannabis Control Board.
Correct.
When your client went in and took the place, was there cannabis there?
There certainly was.
Okay.
And so we called the Cannabis Compliance Board, who came, you know, the day that the district court said in the first action that Greenleaf could come get their stuff. The Cannabis Compliance Board was there to inventory and
okay.
destroy things that were not registered. So.
Okay, thank you.
I don't want to take any more of Ms. Bustero's time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices, and may it please the court. My name is Elsie Lucero, and I represent Respondent Fox Rothschild in this matter. I will discuss two additional independent grounds for affirming the district court's judgments. First, I will discuss issue preclusion, and second, contractual waiver. Fox Rothschild should not have been included in this appeal at all. Greenleaf's claims were not directed at Fox, and none of the allegations in the first amended complaint alleged any specific wrongdoing by Fox. Instead, Greenleaf relied on general references to defendants, even though Fox's only role in this matter was serving as counsel for Belmont during its proper eviction of Greenleaf. The district court, however, correctly granted summary judgment based on issue preclusion. Greenleaf did not challenge this ruling in its opening brief, and therefore this court should affirm that ruling. The district court also correctly granted summary judgment based on contractual waiver. As to issue preclusion, the district court correctly recognized that Greenleaf's claims did not genuinely present new issues. Instead, the claims were an attempt to relitigate issues already determined in the first action based on the same facts. The district court correctly ruled that respondents satisfied each of the elements of issue preclusion. As to the first element, the issues in the first and second action were the same. This court in LaForge v. State University and Community College System of Nevada held, issue preclusion may apply even when the claims are substantially different if the same fact issue is presented. The same applies here. The common issue concerns whether Belmont did what it was obligated to do under the lease following Greenleaf's eviction. The first action litigated the operative issues arising from the lockout, including the disposition of the property under the lease and security agreements. The second action was a repackaged attempt to litigate issues already determined. And as Justice Kadish pointed out, a review of the first amended complaint shows that the both actions were based on the same issues.
But didn't the first action focus more on the reentry issue and the ability to retake the property and an affirmative declaration by the court that there was a breach? Whereas the second action appears to be focusing more on what happened after that in terms of how they secured the property and whether or not they as debtors were being protected under the UCC and the debtor rights were being, I know that's not what the second amended complaint actually says, but I'm sorry, first amended complaint, second action. But you know, if we are to say, if, you know, if we were to take the liberal pleading standards to its bounds and say that there's enough there to suggest that they are raising issues as a secured debtor, those issues were not litigated in the first action, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. They never styled any of their theories under Article 9 in the first action. But looking at their allegations in the second action, it's all about the destruction of the property. The destruction of the property was an issue since before the first action was filed. Belmont sent notices to Greenleaf to come pick up their property. And during that first action, the parties had an emergency hearing about the property, at which Judge Alf gave them more time to come and pick up that property and to be able to raise motions on that property, and they never did. So ultimately, looking at the allegations in the first amended complaint, at the end of the day, it still all goes back to the eviction and Belmont's actions in disposing of the property pursuant to their rights under the lease. And looking at the allegations, while Greenleaf never called it the eviction, a review of the allegations of the first amended complaint shows that they say the May 22nd event, they never say eviction, but the May 22nd event was the date that Belmont locked Greenleaf out of the lease premises. And in the complaint, they expressly state that the first amended complaint in the was pled in the alternative instance and assumes that after the appeal, the first action order will be in pertinent part reversed and or overturned, and or that the applicable appellate court will determine that defendant Belmont was not entitled to have all of Greenleaf's assets transferred to defendant Belmont, and or that defendant Belmont was wrongfully granted ownership rights over all of Greenleaf's assets. Greenleaf therefore conceded that the first action had already determined Belmont's rights and titles to the assets at issue.
Right, but the second action, I don't think they're disputing the ownership, right? So of course conversion doesn't fit, but in terms of their rights as a debtor, in terms of having that collateral work for their benefit in terms of offsets, or you know, maybe if it did go to auction, they could have repurchased it, you know, all of the things that they're complaining about, but it's different, right, than the first action in that sense.
It's different, and yes, in that it wasn't styled as an Article 9 violation, but it's the same in that it goes back to Belmont's rightful disposition based on their remedies following Greenleaf's default. And so the district court in the first action and this court agreed that Greenleaf had breached the lease and said breach gave Belmont the right to conduct the eviction, and that Belmont had title to the assets that were subject to the security agreement. In short, the order of affirmance confirmed Greenleaf defaulted on its obligations, and Belmont thus had the right to re-enter the premises and exercise its remedies, which included disposing of the assets. Although Greenleaf attempted to create a new issue, it was never alleged and proved in the district court, and therefore there's no new issue for purposes of avoiding issue preclusion. And moving on to the second element of issue preclusion, the ruling in the first action was on the merits and final. This court's order of affirmance was no doubt on the merits and final. And next, there is certainly privity between the parties in the first and second action, as Belmont was a party to the first action, and Fox Rothschild as its counsel and Mr. Carlson as its managing agent were always in privity with Belmont at all relevant times. Lastly, the issues were actually necessarily litigated. As established in their first amended complaint, Greenleaf conceded that the second action was always premised on the first action being overturned. Greenleaf had hoped to obtain a favorable reversal from this court, but the opposite happened. Therefore, the district court correctly granted summary judgment based on issue preclusion. Now, moving on to the issue of contractual waiver, the district court also correctly granted summary judgment based on the unambiguous waiver and release of liability in paragraph 10 as to Greenleaf's claim for tortious interference. The district court did not err in interpreting that provision, and it did not narrow the scope of the litigation. The first amended complaint does not identify any conduct other than Belmont's lockout after Greenleaf's default as the basis for any alleged tortious interference. Greenleaf alleges that it had contracts with third parties, including TXR, MJ Holdings, and certain prior customers that Belmont knew about, and that certain products under the agreement were damaged during or after the May 22nd event, again, the lockout. But Belmont's access to any of those products that it allegedly had contracts with third parties for was due only to its right to re-enter the lease premises following their default. There is nothing in the first amended complaint that the tortious interference claim was based on anything other than access to the products during the lockout. And for those reasons, Your Honor, see my time is out here. I would just like to conclude that the district court got it right for several reasons. And as to Fox specifically, affirmance is independently required because Greenleaf alleged no actionable conduct separate from Fox's role as counsel. While the district court did not need to reach the issue, the claims against Fox would have also been barred by the litigation privilege because the alleged conduct arose solely from Fox's representation of Belmont in connection with its proper eviction of Greenleaf. Accordingly, respondents respectfully request that this court affirm in full. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. 3 minutes is incredibly gracious. Thank you very much. First, Justice Stiglitz, to respond to the question that we parted with, the order of affirmance starts by saying that it was not improper to deny 56D relief. However, part of that was because Greenleaf had chosen to file a new action and to pursue these claims under that action. And so that's why I'm saying I agree with the order. I agree with the finding there, and that's what happened. I think it's interesting that we're sitting here arguing that there was insufficient notice pleading when the first action specifically ordered that the goods be turned over pursuant to the security agreement. The security agreement was drafted by Belmont. All the security documents were drafted by Belmont, and they specifically say in their eviction letter that predates the first action that the collateral is the items that they're not allowed to take. So that dovetails into the issue of now we're in the second action and they're arguing that an abandonment notice under 118C can somehow eviscerate the rights of a secured debtor.
But the collateral did not include the cannabis products.
The collateral was subject to a pledge agreement, I'm getting sideways here, Your Honor. There was a question about whether or not the cannabis was considered part of the collateral. That was in the briefing below. That was not something the court chose to address.
So the notices from Belmont that it was going to be retaking the premises,
correct,
and come get your personal items included come get your cannabis, did it not?
It did, if that is the interpretation of inventory, Your Honor. That's what you said earlier is where I tried to draw the line with Judge Kishner, excuse me.
It's fine. And if your client didn't come get the cannabis products after being given the opportunity to do so, then how did they get to complain that the landlord, when they came in, didn't properly take care of it for us? Is that what you think they were obligated to do?
So the issue with the cannabis was the fact that an agent from, one of the defendants in this case actually ended up turning off the air conditioning, and that goes into a whole nother thing that—
Right. So did they have to keep it a nice temperature and keep watering your plants after you left your client, obviously, after your client left them there?
There is a certain obligation to maintain a reasonable interior of the facility, yes. But for this particular instance, Your Honor, majority of the issue here is not about the cannabis, but about the infrastructure and the equipment, the FF&E.
Because I thought like $900,000 of the claim damages relates to the plants.
Correct. And $1.4 million relates to the FF&E and similar product. Okay. And then we have several million that relate to, as Justice Lee, you know, as you pointed out, there was a issue where if we could have obtained some of this collateral back either at a properly noticed auction or something else, then business could have continued. Cool. Now, these are all issues.
But the auction was noticed.
It was never completed, Your Honor.
Right.
It wasn't completed because Greenleaf, at least according to the record, Greenleaf didn't participate and didn't uphold any of their obligations.
Your Honor, I'm out of time. Would you?
No, I'm
trying to follow procedure here to the best of my ability, Your Honors. I promise.
I'm going to have a question after he answers this one.
The short response to that particular issue, Your Honor, and this is really just more of a statutory construction response, is that, yes, while under contract, Greenleaf had an obligation to identify its creditors and to participate in that process, the failure to do so does not immediately eviscerate the obligations of a secured creditor and how they handle collateral. Nevada NRS 104.9 does not say, well, you can contract in such a way that waives your rights. it specifically says you can't do that. So even if it's an implicit waiver by non-performance under the contract, they could have sold that property subject to, at a much lower value, which results in a much lower offset without knowing the credit.
They're not licensed marijuana dealers.
I apologize,
right?
Your Honor. I'm
talking
about the FF&E. If you're talking about the cannabis, we have a very different conversation.
But wouldn't that expose them to potential third-party liability for any interest that a third party may have, which is exactly the list they were seeking from your client?
Oh, absolutely. And if I'm in the landlord's shoes there, I'm liquidating in a fire sale at that point, which I think would be commercially reasonable if you don't know who the creditors are. That's a huge hypothetical, and I think that would be the outcome. But the outcome is not to sit on the collateral and do nothing with it and then give it away for free.
Just, please.
A different question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is Fox Rothschild in this case today? Not why were they in it when somebody else filed a pleading years ago? Why are they in this case today? On what basis?
We went back and forth on this when we were filing the appeal, and this came down to a procedural issue of it was our belief that we needed to include Fox Rothschild to have a complete appeal. That's it. If it comes back down to the district court level, and I'm being very transparent with the court, to the extent it's not a procedural issue, the case looks very different as soon as it gets back down to Judge Kishner. To the extent
you're now relying on the secured party theory of recovery, which seems to be, you know, that's the focus of the arguments here on your part, that's not a Fox Rothschild problem.
No, and Your Honor, I apologize for leaning my back is out, so forgive my body.
No worries.
But as much as I rely on this, no, Your Honor, that's candidly, it's a good question. We did it for the completeness of the appeal, and to the extent that it ends up that we are able to pursue the secure transactions claims, which I continue to believe is appropriate, then it would be against Belmont. Ryan Carlson has nothing to do with this either for completeness of the record, because he is an agent of Belmont instead of an independent actor. And I'm happy, again, to put that on the record.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
All right, thank you.
All right, counsel, this case will stand submitted. It was an absolute pleasure this afternoon. I mean that sincerely. We had a lot of firsts today. First time counsel ever stuck to the time, gave up the podium to let the other counsel actually have the time that they split. You were both, all three of you, responsive, ready, and this was very helpful for us. So thank you kindly.
Thank you.
This was a privilege, Your Honor. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
All rise.